Yes, Bernie was cheated. Yes, the normal that Biden wants to go back to is not all it's cracked up to be. Yesterday, we talked about what a vote for Biden will actually get you. Today, we'll add to that how stinky their tactics have been and why no reasonable person should reward the DNC's gaslighting sociopathy. So we start with an article from The Canary that features Victor Tiffany, OG of the Bernie or Bust movement. Never mind the presidential debate, here is the real video we should all be watching, by Peter Bolton. The first U.S. presidential debate took place this week and has already created a firestorm of commentary. It has been dubbed the worst presidential debate in history, owing largely to U.S. President Donald Trump's churlish behavior throughout. But as the eyes of commentators are focused on this latest entry in the long-running freak show that is the Trump presidency, there is one YouTube video that raises a far more interesting question. Why is it that the careerist Joe Biden is Trump's opponent and not the far more popular and radical Bernie Sanders? On September 29th, Trump squared off against Democratic Party nominee Joe Biden in the first in a series of debates. Trump reportedly interrupted Biden and the moderator over 100 times, often with his usual arsenal of childish insults and petty deflections. Biden also went personal at various points, calling Trump a clown and the worst president America has ever had. The comment that caused the most controversy was in response to the moderator asking Trump if he is willing to unequivocally denounce far-right groups that support his campaign. After moderator Chris Wallace asked specifically about one white supremacist group called the Proud Boys, Trump said that the group should stand back and stand by. This was widely interpreted as Trump giving them a green light to engage in violence in the event he loses. Largely forgotten behind these commentaries, however, is a far more interesting question. How on earth was it that Biden, who is apparently unable to even string a coherent sentence together, became the Democratic Party nominee in the first place? An incisive YouTube video lays out a strong case that fellow candidate in the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders, was robbed of the nomination. Victor Tiffany of Revolt Against Plutocracy said in a message for Bernie Sanders supporters, "Did you ever wonder how Bernie went from frontrunner coming out of Nevada to getting crushed within a period of a week? Or conversely, how did Joe Biden, a weak candidate who did no better than third place in those first three primary contests, go to frontrunner a week later?" Tiffany points out that former President Barack Obama said in 2019 that he would intervene in the primary to stop Sanders. Quoting from the article published in the Washington-based Politico newspaper, Tiffany said, "Back when Sanders seemed like more of a threat than he does now, Obama said privately that if Bernie were running away with the nomination, Obama would speak up to stop him." He added, "That's what happened. That was November of 2019, and after Nevada, Bernie Sanders had won the popular vote in the first three contests. Then, as NBC reported, as Democrats begin to coalesce around Joe Biden as the moderate, by the way, that's a euphemism for neoliberal, moderate alternative to Bernie Sanders, there appears to be a quiet hand behind the rapid movement, former President Barack Obama." Tiffany also mentions how Elizabeth Warren stayed in the race while the other centrist, i.e. center-right, politicians pulled out to back Biden, he said. Tiffany also mentions how Elizabeth Warren stayed in the race while the other centrist, i.e. center-right, politicians pulled out to back Biden. He said, "Obama let it be known that the party had to unify around Biden. That's when Buttigieg dropped out and endorsed Biden, Klobuchar dropped out and endorsed Biden, and Elizabeth Warren didn't drop out. She stayed in the progressive lane and divided that vote to make sure Bernie Sanders couldn't defeat Joe Biden in enough contests going forward." The corporate media giving cover to its paymasters. He argued that the media also played a key part in this plot to prevent Sanders from winning. He said, "And the media collaborated. We have a lengthy article that shows how the media collaborated with the establishment in order to make sure Bernie didn't win the nomination." For Tiffany, there is a very straightforward explanation for why this happened. He said, "Bernie had to be stopped. Not because he'd lose to Trump, although that lie was told, but rather because if he did defeat Trump as the party nominee, he would take over the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party would no longer be the neoliberal corporate party it has been since President Jimmy Carter. Instead, it would be a labor party, and that would cut off all the money, the cash flow coming from Wall Street bankers and corporate America into the party coffers. And the establishment just wasn't going to allow that. Bernie was robbed. Tiffany then referenced the words of former Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who said, "You can't have a revolution inside a counter-revolutionary party." Finally, Tiffany delivered a powerful message to U.S. voters about the upcoming election. Bernie was robbed, and so Bernie supporter, I have to ask you, do you hire burglars to house-sit for you when you're away? Do you hire kidnappers to babysit your children when you're out with your spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend? Because voting for Joe Biden is the equivalent of that kind of stupid behavior. He added, "Trump is the greater of two evils, right?" Wrong! In my next video, I'm going to cover how Biden is the bigger racist, Biden is more violent in foreign policy, Biden is a greater threat to the democratic order than Donald Trump. And Trump is violent too, but Biden is the more dangerous of those two candidates. Tiffany unequivocally recommends a vote for Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins, irrespective of whether one lives in a swing state or a non-swing state. To see the Canary's exclusive interview with Hawkins from earlier this year, click here. And this is me talking. We also had Howie Hawkins on this show earlier this year. He came on and mostly answered questions about U.S. imperialism, because we already had a pretty good idea of his domestic policy. Back to the thrilling conclusion. Clearly, Sanders would now be facing Trump had it not been for the duplicitous machinations of the establishment wing of the Democratic Party and its corporate paymasters. As a result, the contest between the candidates from the two major parties is essentially one in which rival wings of the neoliberal and imperialist status quo jostle over who gets to spend the next 4 years pillaging abroad and imposing austerity upon its own working and middle class at home. We live in bleak times, and casting a vote for this status quo gives a tacit endorsement to its continuation. Perhaps it's time to consign the Democratic Party to the dustbin of history. And as usual, I will link to this article in the information section below. And now we have a counterpunch article by Rob Ury, Election to Nowhere. Expensify! We can't return to normal because the normal we had was precisely the problem. As a metaphor for American electoral politics, the taste test used by marketers of food products is a masterstroke of misdirection. In a taste test, food is reduced to a matter of taste versus digestion, metabolism, nutritional content, conditions of production, and aesthetic appeal for purposes of comparison. The products being compared are chosen to affect a predetermined outcome. They aren't the result of honest inquiry. Finally, majority opinion, a social artifact, is used to place dissenters in a minority position. Choosing a losing product calls one's judgment into question. In the run-up to the Democratic primary in the spring, real problems in need of being solved were put forward. Environmental degradation, the concentration of political and economic power in ever fewer hands, unhinged militarism being driven by business interests, the inability of the electoral system to effect needed changes to capitalist political economy, and the inability of elected officials to plan and implement programs necessary to ensure the perpetuation of the species are political problems in need of solutions. By the time of the general election, these are but distant memories. Implied in the selection of Joe Biden as the Democrats' presidential candidate is that capital, rather than the people, substantially controls the electoral process in the U.S. As much as the contest is proclaimed to be about the restoration of reasoned and responsible governance, the credentialed technocrats, the experts being called upon to save us, are but a different flavor of the tacky shills for capital in the Republican Party. How do we know this? Because capital, the form of U.S. political economy, can plausibly be claimed to be the bipartisan cause of each of these problems, as well as the central impediment to their resolution. So in this first graph, we see that it's the rich who emit the most carbon dioxide. The richest 10% are responsible for almost half of total lifestyle consumption emissions, while the poorest 50% are responsible for only about 10% of total lifestyle consumption emissions. In the graph, climate change is posed as a political problem when its cause is economic. Capitalist production and consumption, concentrated in corporations owned by the rich and in the consumption of goods and services by the rich, are ultimately the cause of most environmental problems. Framing the problem in terms of national interests suggests shared benefit and responsibility, but it is the rich who benefit and who must be made to bear the costs of solving it if solutions are to be found. The poor don't have the means to fix the problem except by forcing the rich to do so. And that, dear viewers and listeners, is why we have guillotines. Not generally considered is that modern elections are an impediment to actionable politics, not an expression of them. Did you get that? Not generally considered is that modern elections are an impediment to actionable politics, not an expression of them. That's effing brilliant. To be clear, the point is to make elections an effective political means, not to end them. The role of Democrats in particular has been to give weak explanations of problems and then assert that little or nothing can be done about them. By treating capital, in the form of corporate interests, as partners in crafting public policy, the result is that public policy is only possible if they benefit from it. Whatever Donald Trump's incompetence, the COVID-19 pandemic was met with Obamacare, not a functioning healthcare system. Ooh. Taken at face value, favoring the candidate who can win begs the question, win what? Winning power without a political program implies that there is no political program, when in the present context, such quite profoundly isn't the case. The existing order is a web of economic and political relationships that remains largely invisible until they are disturbed. Once disturbed, their defense quickly becomes the top priority of the political realm. This can be seen through the rapid delivery of trillions of dollars of public funds to nominally private enterprises during the pandemic shutdown and during the Great Recession. Now here's the truly stunning graph. Following World War II, Democrats and Republicans together saw the world and legislated through the economic relations and institutions of the New Deal, both Democrats and Republicans. The New Deal was extant for both Republicans and Democrats. But from the 1970s forward, Democrats and Republicans together came to see the world through the economic relations and institutions of neoliberalism, both parties. Democrats stopped being the party of the New Deal at the same time that the Republicans did. Residual memory of the difference is a marketing ploy when broader political economy determines the form and function of political interests. So if you haven't figured it out yet, this graph plots the income of the very wealthy. So before the New Deal, the wealthy made a lot of money. During the New Deal, they made much less. After the New Deal, they went up to even higher levels than before the New Deal. So what that shows you is if we get a new Deal, we need to take these motherfuckers completely out of power. We need to remove the billions from the billionaires permanently. We, the people, need to rise up and insist on a form of government that completely eliminates billionaires. As generations of outsiders entering government through reform politics and official programs of inclusion have demonstrated, the system, the institutional prerogatives of capitalist democracy, determines the politics, rather than elected officials determining the system. The congressional black and progressive caucuses have overseen the ascendance of capital, providing ineffectual resistance, and with it the illusion of democratic opposition, along with capitulation at crucial points to restore the political economy they were elected to challenge. The same is true of European social democrats who reliably act as spokespersons and guardians for capital during crises to enforce the capitalist order. Capitalist institutions don't intend to cause environmental destruction, inspire wildly murderous wars with few determinable goals or positive achievements, cause mass economic dislocations, and with them social upheaval, or undermine democratic processes. These are byproducts of the logic of capitalist social relations. And this is the basis of the political logic that solving these problems will cause more economic harm than social benefit. Politicians see the perpetuation of their own power through the logic of the system that produced it. The farce of elections lies in the premise that changing the players will somehow change the nature of this political and economic order. So, dear viewers and listeners, if you ever had any doubt that George Carlin was right, this should absolutely blow those doubts out of the water. George had this figured out a long time ago. Regardless of who wins the upcoming presidential election, the U.S. will resume the nuclear arms race, consume its way to global environmental devastation, consolidate more income and wealth in fewer hands, continue to build out the public-private infrastructure of surveillance and social control, and create an architecture of racial reconciliation that shifts the onus for disparate political and economic outcomes onto those least able to affect them. These are ultimately economic outcomes. Each reflects developed and deeply integrated economic relationships that are difficult to reverse without causing debilitating economic dislocations. So this is me talking. Again, you can see that Black Lives Matter needs a solution, but it's probably going to be an economic solution if we can ever get it to happen. This is an interesting bit about nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are cheaper per unit of destructive capacity than other types of weapons, and military production is central to U.S. economic production. This focus on thrift, particularly given the contribution that military production makes to the national economy, frames economic austerity in a broader light. The production of nuclear weapons makes public-private capitalists rich and serves the alleged national purpose of defense, while the focus on thrift helps legitimate tax avoidance by those who benefit from this process. In fact, the capitalist defense against cuts to military spending is to fire thousands of military production workers. That's really thrifty, isn't it? This same defense mechanism supports the continuation of potentially world-ending environmental destruction. As the top graph illustrates, environmental destruction is overwhelmingly a product of the rich. From the birth of the modern environmental movement to today, environmentalism has successfully been portrayed by opponents as an elite and effete concern. In the 1970s, environmental regulations were enacted with little thought given to the economic dislocations that were their predictable consequence. Competent environmental politics would have assured meaningful employment for dislocated workers. This broad array of economic relations, institutional organization, and prerogatives of power are aligned to perpetuate the existing distribution of power and wealth and to cause severe economic dislocations if it is threatened. So, dear viewers and listeners, what he's saying is that this is just pure extortion. They hold us hostage by making sure that any economic dislocation affects the poor and not the rich. But not just the poor, it affects the bottom 90% and not the top 1%. The path of least resistance is now toward environmental, geopolitical, and social calamity. Insightful in a limited way is the assertion that the 2020 election choice between fast, Trump, and slow, Biden, annihilation. Related is the call for political breathing room, as if every day that environmental problems remain unresolved means they won't be that much harder to resolve in the future. So what he's saying here is that it doesn't matter if it's fast or slow annihilation. It's still fucking annihilation. U.S. adults who name Fox News or MSNBC as their main political news source are equally partisan. People who lean Republican are 93% likely to watch Fox News, 6% who lean Democrat are. And it's a mirror at the bottom of the graph. 95% of the Dems and the Dem leaners are likely to watch MSNBC as their main political news source. And 5% of Republicans and those who lean Republican get their news from MSNBC. This really says a lot if you just sit and study this graph for a minute. Teams red and blue are talking past each other because they get their facts from different sources. The Democrats' insistence that their facts are true and the Republicans aren't, and vice versa, is necessarily from ignorance. There isn't enough cross-readership to produce a determination. This renders the arrogance and self-righteousness of Democrats a particularly loathsome characteristic. Additionally, the source of these facts in commercial and intelligence community channels means that combining red and blue truth is more likely to result in double the insipid propaganda than a merging of partial truths into a whole. So they're both just swilling different forms of propaganda. There is no truth in either source. In 1975, the Church Committee re-forbade the CIA to conduct domestic surveillance and propaganda operations, leaving the option open for it to purchase private surveillance. A recent Netflix documentary on surveillance and social control through the so-called social media, The Social Dilemma, resembles the taste test in terms of misdirection. Not only does social media reside on hardware and software technologies created by the US military, but the CIA was a major funder of social media companies. The oft-stated irony is that users of social media willingly give the CIA, NSA, FBI, and state and local police information through social media that they would guard with their lives if these agencies asked for it directly. However, this formulation still lets private interests off the hook for political behavior hidden behind commercial motives. The problem for capitalists at the outset of the 20th century was that past a low threshold, people didn't want the stuff that capitalism produces. Propaganda, rechristened advertising after the Nazis sullied the concept, isn't necessarily about selling particular products. Modern retailers rely on people buying what they weren't looking for when they walk into a store. Social media broadens and brings this want generation process, the virtual store, to the people. In this sense, social media extends the social construction of consumer culture to an even more stilted and commercialized conception of the self. This process is political, both in the sense that external worldviews are used to manufacture willing selves for commercial ends, and through the use of coercive technologies for explicitly political ends. The red team slash blue team commercial frame of political competition uses real class antagonisms between the PMC, working for its own and the interests of capital, versus the working class and poor that they have been firing, downsizing, outsourcing, desk-killing, surveilling, multitasking, optimizing, and monetizing since the 1970s. The PMC is the public face of capital for the rich to hide behind. PMC refers to professional managerial class, a term coined by Barbara and John Ehrenreich in a 1977 essay for Radical America. The term was originally meant to refer to salaried mental workers who are separated from the capitalist class because they don't control any means of production, but who are also said to have, in Ehrenreich and Ehrenreich's words, an objectively antagonistic relationship to the working class because of the function of their work. The PMC was said to include teachers, social workers, psychologists, entertainers, writers of advertising copy and TV scripts, as well as middle-level administrators and managers, engineers, and other technical workers. What emerged after 2016 was and is the bourgeois nationalist state corporatism of the PMC versus racialized nationalist state corporatism of the Trumpists, American versus European-style fascism, if you will. The PMC spent five decades as agents of capital creating the conditions for capital to benefit from racial and xenophobic scapegoating and then blamed the people they had disenfranchised for looking for scapegoats. And even this doesn't do justice to the outcome. The working class and poor, by and large, didn't bite. The number of racist groups in the US has been declining since 2008, but the class divide is real and gaining momentum. Deference given by establishment Democrats to former suburban Republicans while dismissing the interests of workers, if not precisely of labor, gets to the point that the absence of an articulated political program is no less a political program because it is politically expedient to leave it unstated. Former suburban Republicans are the PMC. A return to normalcy, normalcy in quotations, means the PMC and capital continues to prosper while the lesser 90% of the population continues to see its lot diminished. A recent drive across the heartland found 300 Trump signs for every one Biden sign. With the PMC cloistered in cities and the rich suburbs, true and deep class loathing seems ready to boil over. With respect to commercial propaganda and social media, it is a mistake to grant undue power to shape particular outcomes to these. Marx's insight that we come to know ourselves through our social relations is the basis of a century-old effort to construct capitalist selves, homo economicus, to fill the need for compliant consumers of capitalist products. The statistical saw that as categories are added, people move toward particularity illustrates the ultimate indeterminacy of commercial selves. So what he's saying is, like George Carlin says, we don't have a choice. This propaganda is so powerful that we are just moved wherever they want us to move. And to the studied idiocy that Russia used psychological coercion to swing the 2016 election to Donald Trump, the Democrats and Republicans used exactly and precisely the same methods with several hundred million times more resources. There are myriad real and pressing problems in need of resolution, and we can only solve them by replacing the existing order with social organizations determined to solve them. We, the left, had to try the bird in the hand of electoral politics, but it didn't work. In and of itself, that wouldn't be sufficient reason to write the electoral route off, but what was illustrated is that not only is the electoral route not open to the left, but without a revolution to dislodge the power of capital first, it never will be. This capitulation is undoubtedly what the Democrats were hoping for. However, with a wall of foreclosures and evictions due early next year, and the total unemployed from the pandemic still in the multiple tens of millions of people, establishment politicians are about to get a taste of interesting times. So the main takeaway, dear viewers and listeners, is that we can't solve this through electoral politics until we dislodge the power of capital. And what are the capitalists most afraid of? Property damage. Arson, not to mention armed protesters, especially armed protesters who know where the capitalists live. I know a lot of the comfiest people that watch this show are pretty nervous about the idea of solving our problems this way, but if there's some other way to solve it, let's talk about that. Otherwise, let's figure out that we have to dislodge the power of capital first. If there's some other way of achieving that than riots and strikes, I'll be happy to entertain that idea.